Thank you for joining us for the Parent Survival Kit podcast, from surviving to thriving in your household. To my left is my beautiful bride, as always, Dr. Sonia Schwalen, pediatric expert psychologist, nationally licensed school psychologist. And we also have a very exciting guest today. Hello. Guest we've had on the show outside of ourselves.
That's right.
So we have Dr. Amanda Smith, who is also a pediatric expert psychologist as well. Mm-hmm. And they're both mommies. So today's episode is going to be called Real Talk. So we're going to do some real talk. We've got some questions that I get asked a lot from other dads. I see things on Facebook from different moms, things that are posted. And then we also ventured out to some other people that we know. And I got some really good questions that you don't have a clue about what I'm going to ask. These are questions that...
Not sure. What are you going to do to us today?
Well, we're going to find out. So these questions are questions that I think all parents always want to ask, but sometimes they may be scared or whatnot. And then there's some parents that throw these things out there on social media like it's nothing. So we want to address some of those questions as well. So real talk, let's get started. This is going to be the episode one, and more geared towards children. And then episode two will be more geared towards our adolescent and teens.
Okay. So that all means right. We have to do this again.
Perfect.
Yes. Two episodes. Today is episode one. You guys ready?
We're ready.
Yep. I think. All right. So let's see here. One question that we get a lot is, I think my kid, or one thing that parents throw out there a lot is, I think my kid has ODD. What do you say about that?
Okay. So you want to take this or should I? Because I have.
I think we can probably both address it.
Okay.
We'll just bounce off of each other.
Let's do it. So I think my kid has ODD. You're right. I've actually seen that posted different places. I've seen it come up in conversations with other moms. I see it everywhere. It's so common where parents will either conclude that about their child, or pediatricians will say that about someone's child. Mm-hmm. And I get really, really concerned when I hear ODD thrown out. So let's just talk about what that means first, and then I'm going to tell you why I get so concerned about it. So ODD stands for Oppositional Defiant Disorder. And basically what it means when someone meets criteria for that is that they are pretty oppositional and they're defiant, usually towards figures of authority. And parents tend to feel like nothing they can do is good enough, because their child tends to really struggle with a lot of behavioral problems. So it could be a lot of defiance, it could be this feeling of disrespect all the time, non-compliance, and just a lot of rift and stress and tension in the parent-child relationship whenever I hear parents use that term. Mm-hmm. The reason I'm really scared of that term, and my heart tends to break when I hear, you know, kids being diagnosed with ODD or just thought of as having ODD, is because a lot of times in the schools and in society, ODD is associated with social maladjustment, okay? And so what that implies is that someone who has ODD is a lost cause. There's nothing we can do for them. And then they're on this trajectory to then go on and develop conduct disorder. Conduct disorder is a really scary diagnosis too, because it means that an individual may be doing really deviant types of behaviors where they have no respect for authority in the community. So they're not afraid of police officers, for example. They may set things on fire. They may kill animals. They may do things that are just considered very, very deviant. And then that can...
I was going to just say, it's sometimes just associated with, like, quote unquote, the bad kid.
Yes.
Right? Like this is a bad kid.
Right. And so then it becomes like this hopeless case almost, this reputation that this person has because somebody labeled them first in the early years as having ODD, and then maybe it manifested into what they call conduct disorder. And then eventually a small percentage of those individuals will actually go on to develop antisocial personality disorder, which are the types of people that we generally see committing crimes and ending up in prison. Okay. So that's like worst case scenario. And I paint that picture because I kind of want to scare people into not labeling their child with ODD. Mm-hmm. We as psychologists will tread very carefully around that label. And even when we're linking systems of care and helping school personnel know how to help this student who is also our client, we're going to do what we can to stay away from that ODD label if we really believe that maybe this child is having difficulties because they have anxiety or depression, or they may have experienced some major change lately. Maybe there's a divorce that they're dealing with in the family, or a new sibling came along. And so we really want to look at the big picture before we're ever going to use a diagnosis like that.
And just understanding, like, what's the purpose of that behavior, right? Because yes. A lot of times, you know, you think of just when you were a kid, why were you being defiant? There's a lot of different reasons that those things can come up. And so being able to understand what's underneath is going to be able to help us, like, really just address it.
Yeah, so the purpose of the behavior, the function of the behavior. Because what we also know about kids is that they communicate to us through their behavior. It's really hard for kids to talk to us about what they're feeling or what they're thinking, but that's also really developmentally appropriate. You can't expect a 6 or 7 year old kid to put into words exactly what they're thinking or feeling, because it's just not where they're at cognitively, right? And so they're gonna show us how they're feeling through their behavior.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Well, and you talked about conduct disorder as well, and I think you've told me before in the past with some of these posts that we've seen is that, you know, that's also someone doing these really bad things, the bad kid, without having any remorse whatsoever, you know, and most of the time.
Thank you for that. We have remorse. You've been listening. I like that. That's a key characteristic of some of these disorders is that a person who truly meets that criteria is also not going to have any remorse. They really struggle socially to even feel bad for the things that they've done.
Yeah, that's good to know. So our kids are not ODD. So when our younger kid is doing something wrong and I say, don't do that again, he turns around and does it again on purpose, he's not ODD. He's just misbehaving. He's just being a kid.
I'm gonna jump in right there. Maybe he's not misbehaving. Maybe he's exerting control and learning his boundaries and trying to see, like, oh, if I do this, then this happens, and understanding cause and effect and just starting to understand that he has an impact on his environment, right?
See, dads, we really need this conversation today with two brilliant psychologists and also mommies. So we're going to dig in a little bit deeper. So the ODD, self-diagnosing our kids, always very bad because that also can change the way we approach them, how we think of them, and really what others think about our kids too. And we see a lot in the schools. Schools a lot of times are diagnosing our kids with ADD, ADHD. There's some questions that I want to ask about being ADD or ADHD. There's a lot of times that, you know, we want to talk about our kids being that way because they can't focus in school. They lose their train of thought. They can't remember anything. Talk to us about what is ADD, ADHD? Is it really a real diagnosis that's so prevalent out there that we talk about so much, or is it being misdiagnosed more than ever?
Okay, that's a loaded question. You want to talk about what ADD and ADHD is?
Yeah, so I think it's that is a loaded question. Gene's got these questions that got like so many different facets into them.
He's a multifaceted man.
I think a lot of times when people say, oh, my kid's ADHD or my kid's ADD, first of all, the ADD diagnosis is technically not even around anymore. It's now considered ADHD hyperactive type, ADHD inattentive type, or ADHD combined type, where they're having both the inattentiveness as well as the hyperactivity. And so even understanding there's actually like three of those that helps us kind of distinguish, but difficulties concentrating, impulsive behaviors. One, it's really hard with kids in general to kind of help determine what is appropriate, what is not, right? Sometimes it may be that their concentration is getting impacted by lack of nutrients. It could be that they're spending so much time on their iPad that they're used to getting this like immediate reward, and now all of a sudden they can't have that reward really quickly, and now it's a different problem. Or it could be that they're actually dealing with other things. right? Maybe they're having difficulties concentrating at school because there's other things going on at home. It could be that they're getting really anxious about their performance, and so now they're having difficulties concentrating. And so, once again, it's one of those things that you really got to kind of dive in and dig apart, and trying to figure out what is the reason for the lack of concentration. Is it there is difficulties in the brain actually concentrating, or is there other factors impacting that?
Yes. And I love that you said that, because there is difficulty concentrating as one of the like key factors of an ADHD diagnosis. But then we also see different symptoms like forgetfulness and procrastination. We see inability to complete tasks. And so often when I hear that, you know, little mix of symptoms, I want to also know, you know, is this child anxious? Is this child depressed, malnourished? Are they used to, like, you know, you said, Dr. Smith, looking at an iPad all day or a tablet all day, and then all of a sudden when they're asked to function in the real world, it doesn't emulate what they're used to on their technology world. They don't even know how to function anymore. And we see that all the time. And so it's not really a question of, do they have ADHD? It's really, do they just need to be retaught how to function in the real world? And with anxiety, we see all the time, and depression, you know, forgetfulness, inability to concentrate and inability to complete tasks. So often I'll ask, you know, what's happening with you when you're being forgetful or not able to finish a task? And the person will say, well, you know, I'm working on one assignment, and then I remember that I needed to go clean my room. So I stopped what I was doing and I ran to my room to clean it up. And while I was doing that, I started thinking about how Mom wanted me to empty the dishwasher. So I stopped cleaning my room and actually went to go empty the dishwasher. That's not someone who can't finish a task because they have concentration problems. Or ADHD, it's someone who can't finish a task because they're so anxious that they're up in their head all day thinking about all their long list of things to do. And so when we're able to kind of help families differentiate, well, this is what ADHD is and why, and then this is what other anxiety or depressive disorders look like and why, and sometimes they all look exactly the same, we have to go a little deeper.
So that means that really to figure it out, we need to see a professional, because I know a lot of times we have PCPs, pediatricians, that are diagnosing ADHD, even medicating kids. So how do we figure out if our kid does have ADHD, or is it really just something like anxiety or depression or something else?
Yeah, I mean, I like what you said. You know, pediatricians a lot of times are diagnosing ADHD. I will say, you know, they use different rating scales that are made, honestly, for parents and teachers to complete whenever they are filled out. It's going to make most people look like they have ADHD. Those questionnaires are just basic screeners. It's a good starting point, but it's definitely not enough to make a differential diagnosis and start treating someone. So the assessment process is pretty it's in depth. It's very adequate. It's thorough.
Very comprehensive.
And it's very comprehensive. That's exactly right. And so
check up from the neck up. We talked about a few weeks ago.
Yes, the check up from the neck up. Right. That's your favorite thing to say to clients. So do you want to talk a little bit about that assessment process and why it's so important to differentiate diagnosis?
Yeah, so we're going to be looking at a lot of different areas when we do that evaluation. We're looking at background history. We're looking at consistency in behavior across time. We're looking at genetic predispositions, which is, I think, is always really interesting because different diagnoses will have different amounts of genetic predisposition. So seeing a history of certain diagnoses will help us kind of also differentiate. Okay, is there a if this is very genetically based, we really want to see a pattern of behavior within the families in general. But also, just once again, kind of even thinking of trauma, right? Like, let's even dive into trauma. Trauma can often cause a lot of that difficulties concentrating, kind of daydreaming like behavior, as well as some of those impulsive behaviors as well. So we really want to kind of look at all of those parts. On top of that, we're going to be doing different tasks and testing. So we're going to be asking questions from parents and teachers. We're also going to be gathering information about what your child is capable of doing and trying to differentiate that while also doing observations of like, how are they interacting with us? How are they responding when mom is in the room? How are they responding when mom's not in the room? How are they responding when it's an academic task? How are they responding when it's a cognitive task? How are they responding when it's considered a quote unquote fun task where there's not a need for performance? And so being able to look at all these different factors will help us be able to differentiate what is what.
Yeah.
Wow, that's phenomenal. It really is when you think about it. So you mentioned screen time and phones, and, you know, that's a big topic all the time as far as questions that we get. How much time is too much time for screen time? What age should my child be at before I put a screen in front of them, which we're seeing all the time at different ages these days? And then I kind of want to know as a dad, when do I start having like concerns about my child not being able to interact outside the screen time and being different and whatnot? They can't socialize the same, or what does that look like? What does that mean? So what is screen time? When is it too much time? And then how do I know if it's affecting my kid?
That's a good question, especially right now. I feel like during this pandemic, screens have become more and more prevalent. And the difficulties separating from screens have become a bigger thing, whether it's because the schools are now virtual or also just being stuck in the house and not knowing as much activities to be able to get your kids to do outside of the home.
Well, yeah, that's a great point too, because, you know, even before the pandemic, you know, we had some concerns about our older son in high school, and everything's done through the computer, laptop these days. Yeah. There's no homework. It's all through Google this, Google that. And we're like, everything's on the screen. And so that he has an excuse. What are you doing? I'm doing homework. Really? Are you really doing homework? You know, so all this screen time, but now with everything being virtual and I have to be on my screen all the time, but yeah, this is not what I'm doing for fun. I still want my fun time, screen time. How do we navigate that?
Yeah. So what is screen time was your first question. Screen time is any time spent in front of a screen looking at the screen. Okay, so it's any type of screen. It's a television screen, a tablet, a cell phone, a computer, a video game. I mean, I guess that would be a TV or whatever they're playing the game on. So it's any time spent looking at a screen equals screen time.
Okay.
Okay. The American Academy of Pediatrics actually recommends no more than 1 to 2 hours for kids on a screen during the day. And 0 hours of screen time for children under the age of 2. So we have totally blown that away, right? We're doing way more than 1 to 2 hours of screen time a day if we're at home doing virtual school, and if we're just at home, like in the pandemic, trying to find ways to help our kids spend the day.
Yeah, absolutely.
So everyone's totally blown that one up.
Yeah,
it's just done, right? We can't even follow that recommendation. Yeah, not at all.
And we were visiting preschools and whatnot for our younger one, and you know they were doing a lot of screen time during the day just for educational purposes before the pandemic. So it's like it's something that's being put into every curriculum starting at very young ages.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's well-intentioned. I hear teachers talking about it all the time where they say they are moving towards a more technology-friendly classroom and they're trying to integrate technology more into their lessons because that's just how kids learn these days, or that's what resonates with them. And I talk to parents all the time about, you know, you really need to think about that. You don't necessarily have to integrate technology into your child's classroom. They can learn without it. They still have that brain that we were all born with and can understand concepts and problem solve without the use of technology. So it's really at that point a parenting decision, you know, if they want to enroll their child in a classroom that integrates a ton of technology use into the curriculum. You don't have to. You can make that decision, you know, personally for your family. What were some of your other questions about screen time?
So what do I know if screen time is really affecting my kid, and how do I navigate that?
You want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, you can probably jump off of it too, but a lot of times you'll start seeing a lot of problem behaviors of like, when you take the screen away, how do they respond? Are they able to cope? Are they able to like adapt? Are they able to respond in a positive way? Do you notice them getting stuck on like being more irritable right? So a lot of times, even just like doing a technology detox, you notice a change in your kid's behavior.
What's a technology detox?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. Time away from the screen. Taking an extended time away from the screen, that's going to allow the brain to almost heal and just take time.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like with a drug addiction. We put addicts through detox process. It would be the same thing for a technology addiction. And so, you know, to piggyback off of what Dr. Smith said, we see irritability, we might see more emotionality, more temper tantrums, difficulty transitioning off of the screen and onto whatever you need them to do next. If you give them warnings ahead of time, you'll start to notice that they are fighting that warning, you know.
Or bribing for more time. Just right. Two more minutes, or I haven't done this, or I haven't done that.
Yeah, and then when you see the meltdown, it's frustrating, it's draining, but parents, it's also your fault because you put them in front of the screen for that long, right? And I say that jokingly. I really do, because we all know how hard it is to keep our kids off the screen these days. So it's
well, let's face it, I mean, you know, it's so tough. What battles do we want to really fight?
Yeah.
You know, there's so much going on these days. It's a great babysitter. We see kids in restaurants with it, which I definitely do not agree with. But sometimes, what do you do? I mean, I've got so much going on. Do I really want to deal with a tantrum? You know, I've got a good friend of mine that he gets home from work and his 4-year-old owns his phone. If you try to reach him at night, it ain't happening because she's hitting decline on calls. Text messages. I mean, they know how to flip the screen off and everything else. I mean, it's pretty funny, but again, what battles do we fight? So how do we get away from too much screen time and really know when to limit them? Because it's definitely hard. Also, we've got so much things to do. If we have more than one kid, we're trying to get dinner ready. It's tough.
Yeah.
I take that. You got some ideas for how parents can limit screen time and direct?
I think even just having a conversation with either other parents or the parent that you're also co-parenting with about just like, okay, what is our priorities? What are the things that we value and what are the things that we're noticing, right? So for each family, it may be a little bit different as well of like, okay, well, when I'm making dinner, I need to get some work done, but like after dinner, let's set all these limits. Or it just may look different for everyone. I think the biggest thing is having that conversation, noticing what's going on with your child. Cause I've even had times where I've noticed my child, I'm like, your temper tantrums are increasing. Let me like really think on what's going on and how can I kind of give some space. Cause even that technology detox, sometimes a lot of people will think, oh my gosh, they're never going to be able to figure it out. And it's like that technology detox almost like resets their brain, resets them to where they're used to engaging in other behaviors, where it actually makes it a lot easier afterwards. And there's not as much difficulties after that.
No, I totally agree. And I see that all the time with our toddlers at home, because when they've had way too much TV or way too much looking at pictures on the phone or whatever they like to do, they're throwing more tantrums, right? Mm-hmm. But then as soon as we realize it, remove it for a couple of days even, and keep redirecting them so they become more interested in their toys or the activities that we know they have to do around the house, it's not even an issue anymore. You know, yeah. They're not even really asking for it anymore. So they're so resilient. Like, that's the cool thing about kids, is they're so resilient that they will adapt to the new normal really quickly. It just takes the discipline on us as the parents to make it happen.
So basically what I'm hearing is having some discipline, some communication around screen time, and really just following through with the structure we put in place.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right, so you mentioned tantrums around screen time. We see it all the time. There's some questions about, what do I do when my kid is in the middle of the grocery store and throws that big, huge tantrum, and you're like so embarrassed, you just want to walk, that's not my kid, sorry. You know, mama, what do you do for a tantrum like that? I mean, you know, I've seen parents like lose it. You know, some parents can handle it very well, but what do you do?
That's a great question. There's a whole bunch of different ways to handle that exact situation. I know I have some ideas. You can jump in with some of your ideas. So if it's like a really big tantrum and parents are coming to me and I'm going to say, like, how often does that happen? Is this a recurrent thing? You know, are you normally giving in to whatever they want? And then the moment you say no, they up the ante. Well, let's work on setting limits and being more consistent with that. But if it's in the moment, you know, my recommendation honestly is to set some limits, like in a very calm voice, just say, we're not going to be able to do X, Y, Z, whatever the child is throwing the tantrum over, until you show me that you're ready. And we can't do this in the grocery store, so we're going to go to the car and we're going to give you a chance to calm down. And so then that way, like, all eyes aren't on you. You might have to ditch the shopping cart. You might literally just have to pick your child up off the floor and go to a less stimulating environment, which is the car, and let it play out the way it's going to play out. Now, the hope is that you let the child know, like, I still love you and I'm here when you're ready. And ready means you're going to be calm, not crying, not screaming anymore, and able to talk in a tone that matches mine. As soon as those things happen, we can move forward. And so I always say prioritize the child. Use that moment as like a teaching moment. Like, parenting doesn't just happen when we feel like it. It's kind of an all day, everyday thing. And if it means we literally have to shift and ditch the shopping cart and walk out of the store and the whole day is thrown off and we didn't get anything accomplished, sometimes that's what it takes.
So don't give them a screen. Okay. Just wanted to clarify.
What would you say about that scenario?
I mean, once again, it kind of depends on the kid too. You know, like, one kid may want to go to the car. Another kid may not care, right? Other kids may be the ones that don't care if they throw temper tantrums in front of other people, while as other kids do care. And so being able to figure out, okay, like, is it helpful to go to the corner of the grocery store? Is it helpful to make sure you're bringing certain activities for your kid? Because it is, if you're spending an hour in a grocery store, it's really hard to have any kid sit there for an hour without something to do. Not saying it's going to be technology, but like even just like a book or coloring or I always try to involve my child in the shopping. So like talking of like, oh, we're going to get this and we're going to get that. And I make it this like fun activity and I like hand him the things to put in the cart because he loves that. And so it creates this like enjoyable time. So that's like some of the things I just do myself.
Well, yeah, it sounds like proactive strategies, like to prevent the tantrum from happening, right?
Well, and I like to go to the aisle where they have all the buckets with all the different candies and everything else, you know, that you scoop out, you know, and just let them reach in and take what they want. And
really? Because I do everything I can to make sure they know that aisle doesn't exist.
Yeah, but we know that's not true. Ours love to go to the store because it's snack time, so they get to eat anything and everything in the cart. Apples off the shelf, it doesn't matter what it is. God made dirt, and dirt don't hurt. So, one more question around screens and phones is, what age should I allow my kid to have a phone or a tablet or whatnot?
That one's tricky. I think that's
that's a really hard one.
It is, because it's really a parenting decision. You know, if we're going to be working with families in a session and we're talking to families about this exact question, we're going to encourage them to make a list of pros and cons, to look at their reasons for really wanting to give their child a phone. I'm always of the mindset, you know, delay that from happening as long as you possibly can, but also don't delay it so much that you don't have time to teach your child how to use that technology, right? So children much easier can understand like your level of involvement if you do it early on. So if you give them a phone, be strategic about how you do it. Let them know what the rules are around use of that phone. Help them understand that like you have access to that device at all times, no matter what. You know all the passwords. I mean, there's ways to do it. So I always want to make sure that we're talking to parents about, first, what are your reasons for wanting to do this? Let's look at your child's age. Let's make sure it's appropriate so they understand all the boundaries around it. Because the earlier you start that, the easier it is for them to just know no different, right? If they don't know any different, when they do become a teenager and there's a lot more challenges associated with having a cell phone, it's just second nature to them to know that you're involved and you're going to help them with whatever challenges they face during those times.
Yeah, that makes sense. Have a game plan. Yeah. Yeah. Thinking about all the other things that could come up. You know, Steve Jobs, you know, had said at one point in time that he wouldn't give his kids a phone until they were 13. And, you know, he's, you know, the one behind Apple and Apple phones and everything else that we have to have a new phone every year now, right? So,
well, even just thinking about, like, what does it mean to have a phone, right? Like, I always think, like, the World Wide Web is literally the World Wide Web. If you don't feel comfortable with your kid going anywhere in this world, then there needs to be limits on, there has to be limits on the World Wide Web, right? And so just even thinking of it in that practical way, like, if I do give my kid a phone, what access are they having on that phone? What are they having just ability to do while they're on that phone? And then what are the limits? Just kind of like what you said, like, yeah. What's the limits? What's the boundaries? What's the purpose? What are ways that we can appropriately teach our kids how to engage in technology, but not at a point where they don't understand?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, and this episode is, you know, really directed more towards 12 and under, right? So it made me think of my friend again, who gives his 4-year-old his phone, and it, you know, because it's already happening, it may be better off that he gets her own phone so he can have limits on there that he doesn't have on his phone, because thinking about limits and whatnot, does he really have all these limits on his phone? So she literally has access to the World Wide Web on his phone, right? So that can be a very scary thing. Kind of getting back to the school thing. So we see this quite a bit. What do I do, or what's wrong with my kid? His preschool calls up all the time. He's misbehaving. He doesn't listen. He's on his third preschool in 12 months. I don't know what to do. I'm done. What do I do?
Maybe he has ODD.
That's not funny.
We actually see this all the time in the clinic. I mean, parents will call stating that their child has problems at daycare, you know, and they're 2, 3, 4 years old, and they've had to do exactly what you said, start over multiple times. In this situation, I always say, you know, get a professional involved. There are a lot of different reasons why kids have trouble at such young ages in the structured school or classroom setting. And we can't make assumptions. We have to get down to the bottom of it. We have to do our research. And, you know, when you bring on a pediatric psychologist to do an assessment, their role is truly to act as a detective and to really gather as much information as possible to start understanding, like, why the current pattern is in place. Okay. And so in that situation, I would absolutely recommend calling a professional, getting in front of a child psychologist and asking for a full assessment. Don't just assume the worst. Don't think that your child will never survive the school setting or there's something absolutely wrong with them. It could be just as simple as maybe there's been a major change at home, like I mentioned earlier. Maybe there is a brand new sibling. Maybe, you know, 3 different schools in less than a year span has been so traumatic for them that they're just having trouble finding their way and don't know what to do to be successful in any given environment. So,
or they may have just, like, figured out how to get more time with mommy.
That's exactly right.
They're like, oh, if I keep doing this, you know, now it's like a learned behavior. Mm-hmm.
And kids are really, really resilient. They can figure out ways to get what they need.
One, it could be just even behavior. For attention. They're not getting at home or whatnot, and it's tough, you know, because as the mom or the dad, you know, we have to leave work, pick the kid up, and now we can't go back to school, so now we have to find a way to get them into another school. So it's very, very frustrating. So so seek the help of a professional pediatric psychologist and then kind of go from there.
I would absolutely recommend that, yes.
All right, so my kid is 8 and started wet in the bed again. Where does that come from? What am I going to do?
These complex questions, I think.
We're going to be all over the place for the next few minutes, though.
I think that sometimes that can be psychological and sometimes those can be medical. I think the first thing to do is just contact your pediatrician, get a checkup, start getting kind of information if there's any type of medical problem that could be associated with that. If no medical issue is starting to come place, then reaching out for help from a psychologist is going to be a really good idea.
And then again, we'll be the detective and get down to the bottom of it.
So basically what I'm hearing, if we're seeing changes in behaviors or patterns and just regular functioning, then there could be some concerns there. So definitely take it serious and get the help that they may need.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're seeing changes in physical functioning, right? So if all of a sudden they weren't wetting the bed, but now they are, and it seems like it's chronic, it's not tied to anything that you can pinpoint. Because sometimes kids will wet the bed because they are, again, going through some major transition, or they are learning how to potty train, and they don't know how to stay dry through the night yet. I mean, there's all different reasons why kids can wet the bed. But if it's one of those things where, you know, it doesn't seem like there's any real reason or reasonable trigger for this to happen, and it's not improving, mm-hmm. you know, we want families to first go rule out something medical in a situation like that. And then once that has been ruled out, we can absolutely address it psychologically as well.
Okay. Because, you know, just thinking about it, there could be things that, you know, maybe they watched a show, maybe they're having fears or nightmares, or, I mean, there could be all kinds of things that are underlying that we just don't know.
Right. And maybe they're drinking a lot of water right before bed, too.
I know, right? There's that detective in you.
That could definitely happen. So I asked my kid what was going on, but they always lied to me, so I'm just being silly. But we do have a question. So my kid's always lying to me. How do I address that? What do I do?
Okay. I love this question. I hear it all the time from families that I work with. And usually, and we don't like to make assumptions, again, that's why we'll do the full assessment. But a lot of times when kids are lying, again, like Dr. Smith mentioned, it's a learned behavior. So there's some function to it. Maybe a child has learned, like, if I tell the truth, that will get me in trouble. Or so it's like an avoidance pattern. Or I lie because it serves some function for me. Okay. Now, if lying gets a big response from mom or dad, like, you know, I told you not to do this and I don't like it when you lie, and then parents go into some kind of lecture mode, it could very much be that a child is just looking for some attention, and this is how they get that from their parents, even if it's negative attention. They're trying to engage that relationship, right? So there's always different questions that we have to ask to find out what's the function of the lying behavior. And then I like to talk to parents about how much time do you spend actually praising and rewarding them when they are honest and telling the truth. Because just like lying is a learned behavior, being honest and telling the truth can be as well. And so if we're modeling telling the truth and being honest ourselves, that's one way to teach it. But then also to say, like, I'm really proud of you because you came to me and you shared with me, and that must have been scary for you, but you did it anyways. I love you and I'm really proud of you because you did the right thing. Those types of feedback can be really helpful to start forming that behavior in your child. So instead of focusing on the lying, we actually focus more on the truth telling. And that's a really good way to help kids with shifting that behavior. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different reasons lying could happen.
Yeah.
Sometimes it could be a worry about telling the truth. Maybe there's a lot of shame associated with it. If I share this, or this behavior means I'm a bad person. So even just parents starting to differentiating between your child's behavior and who they are, right? Just because they made a poor choice doesn't mean they're a bad kid. And so being able to help differentiate and saying those are different can help reduce that shame of, like, I need to hide these behaviors because if I'm engaging in this behavior, I must be bad. And then the same sense of, like, oh, I'm told that I'm really good because I make good grades, right? Now you're setting that kid up to think, oh, well, if I don't make good grades, then I'm not a good kid, right? And so being able to help differentiate, like, I'm so proud of you for working so hard. It's awesome that you've been able to earn these things, but mommy still loves you, even if, you know, you do something bad or you end up struggling with grades at some point.
Right. And so lying also could be to prevent hurting someone or disappointing somebody, right? So we always want to look at the function of it and then address it from there.
Excellent. Well, you mentioned grades and high achievers and whatnot. So I want to kind of dive into sports. So as a dad and a coach and someone who really loves sports himself, let's talk about, like, sports in general. Like, how many sports is too much for a kid? I know there's different ages we're talking about here, but Can a kid be in too many sports at a young age, too many events at the same time?
Yes. I mean, every kid is different, right? And every family is different. Yes, the answer to that is yes. I mean, too much of a good thing can go bad. And so, again, I always encourage families to look at their values as a family. You know, what's really important to them? What do they want to be spending their time on? What's the purpose for enrolling their children on different sports teams? You know, are they trying to get their child to experience a variety, to figure out what they like? Or is it important to the parents that the child learns how to be a team player and, you know, grows and develops a sense of character by being a teammate? I mean, I hear all different kinds of things from parents. It's like why they've scheduled their children in multiple sports. And so we really have to get back to the basics. I always say that to families is what's important to you? What are you trying to accomplish? And like, do we need to remove things from your plate in order to get there? So it's always a bigger picture type of conversation when we're addressing that question. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also just monitoring over time of like, how is this impacting my kid, right? I think of even myself, I was a gymnast for a really long time. And by age 8, I was in the gym 20 hours a week, which is a lot of time for an 8-year-old. And so being able, and I remember my parents really having a lot of conversations, and it's something that I continue to have conversations with my husband about is like, okay, if our child ends up wanting that, what things do we need to look for? Are they, what is the values of our family? Can this line up with that? Is it turning into something that is now unhealthy, or is this something that's continuing to be fun and a passion?
Yeah,
that makes perfect sense too. Yeah, so, yeah, because I see a lot of kids in coaching. Like a lot of kids are playing because their parents want them to. They want that football player, that baseball player, that gymnast, whatever it may be. And then you see competitiveness on some teams that are just sometimes a little bit too intense for some kids. Again, it depends on what the kid really wants and kind of how much they're enjoying the sport, right? So it's very good information to definitely be evaluating. I know that with our older son, he did 5 sports in middle school and was on the honor roll and whatnot. And he excelled in sports for a very, very long time and really loved them. But then when he got to high school, he really decided that he didn't really love it that much anymore. So it was hard as a dad and his coach through all these years and seeing how great and successful he was and how talented he was. But at the end of the day, the kid has to really make the decision what they really want. So,
and that's a good point. Like, it's evaluating your own emotions and your ties to this as well. It's like, as a parent, am I wanting this maybe even more than my kid is?
Absolutely. I see it a lot. Watching our 8-year-old at gymnastics, you know, and she's not competitive. She's just out there having fun one day a week. And there's other parents there with kids that are on the competitive team. Mm-hmm. And just how they converse and talk and some of the things they say is really pretty crazy. It's really pretty out there.
It's just intense. It becomes a way of life, right? And it takes over the family's lifestyle. And some families are fine with that and some aren't. And so that's really the discussion that we have to have with parents.
Yeah, and, you know, since we're on this topic really quick, I mean, the select team that I coached, what we did was something different because there are so many teams like these days, everybody, if my kid's going to play this sport or whatnot, I want my kid on the select team, the best team and whatnot. And there's so many teams out there that if you have the money to pay for it, you can be on the team for the most part, right? And some of these teams are playing competitive, you know, sports every single weekend, traveling and whatnot. And it has a big, huge impact on the family and on the kids as well. So finding that balance is really what's going to be most important. So, all right. So moving from sports, we've got sibling rivalry. So we've got siblings that maybe I have 3 kids and 2 of them like to hang out and the other one's left out, or maybe they just don't like each other, or they're always tantruming with each other and picking on each other. So how do we navigate our kids when they're fussing, fighting with each other, making each other cry? I know when I was growing up, if one of us started to cry in my household, I'm one of 4. my dad would run out and he'd yell at all of us, we're all in trouble, right? So.
And then everybody's crying.
And then everybody's crying.
Just got worse, right?
Yes, and everyone's looking for mama. And yep.
So sibling rivalry is really a normal part of development. And so it's just kind of to be expected that kids in general are going to fight over territory. They're going to fight for attention. They're going to frustrate one another. It's just a part of growing up together with a sibling. So it's not something that, you know, we get super concerned about. In fact, we want to hear that siblings have a more normal relationship where sometimes they get along and they play well together one moment, and then the very next moment they hate each other and they're ripping each other's hair out, and then they recover very quickly from that and they're best friends again. So this like intense love-hate relationship between siblings can be a very normal thing. I always say, you know, be sure that your kids are safe. If they're in danger, like immediately intervene. Sometimes it's appropriate to allow them to work out their issues on their own, because that's also how they develop socially and learn how to move into a place of conflict resolution. Some of that is very natural and it happens in the sibling relationship. Other times, it's very necessary for parents to intervene. Now, I don't know if, you know, storming in and yelling is the best approach. I would actually recommend, you know, going in, observing, assessing the situation. All of that takes just a few seconds, honestly, and then intervening the way you feel like you need to. So if you need to get down on the floor and involve yourself somehow to teach the kids how to resolve the issue, if you need to remove a child from the situation just because that's what's going to help in the moment, if you need to separate both of them and let them both have, or more than both, two or three, however many there are, and let them all kind of have a calm down time. I mean, every situation is going to be different. So parents can kind of like take it as it comes and assess as it comes and then follow their instinct in those circumstances. What do you think?
Yeah. Or even just thinking about how are you modeling conflict in the home as well? Right? Us as parents are the models. And so being able to model how do we address and engage in conflict and how do we resolve that can help with the kids even like learning how to resolve issues between themselves.
Absolutely. They watch everything we do, right? And they see everything we do.
Yeah. And we do that with our 8-year-old and our 17-year-old. They'll play and then they'll fight. They'll play and they'll fight. And so we just tell them, look, communicate your boundaries. If someone says stop, respect them enough. So we're teaching communication, boundaries, and respect, kind of all in the same, you know, scenario. So, all right. So when it comes to siblings, I think my spouse favors one of the kids more than the other. Is that normal? Is that wrong? Should I be concerned?
Ooh, that's a heavy question.
That's a really heavy
question.
Someone
put a lot of thought into that.
I always say the first thing to do is talk to your spouse.
Right? I agree.
Like if you're seeing something, being able to talk to them, if that conversation's not going well, then getting someone else to help out will be really helpful. But it's kind of a.
So let's think about this. So we have parents and you can have a husband and a wife that are completely different and just love different things. My wife could love to sit there and read books all day. And I'm the outdoorsy, want to be athletic and sports and whatnot. And one of our kids is just like my wife as an example. And this is not personally for us, but just an example. And so one of my kids just wants to be a bookworm, which is great. And then my other kid he's really athletic and wants to be with daddy and doing all this. So, I mean, maybe there is some favoritism. Is that okay, though? Is that normal? Or is that, I mean, doesn't mean that, I wouldn't necessarily love both kids equally, but maybe I just have more in common.
Sounds like it's sometimes easier to connect with some kids rather than others. I think that's what it's not necessarily favoritism, right? But sometimes it is easier to connect with some kids over another. As a human being in general, there is some natural tendency to that, but it's also going to be important to figure out how do you connect with all of your kids?
That was going to be my next question. So when we do have this happen, which I think is very common, what do we do as the parent to make sure that we are giving both kids some equal time and being on their, being with them in the way they want to be, sought after.
Or you do just that. I mean, you just become very intentional about making sure you enter your child's world and you do the things that they like to do. And so, like Dr. Smith said, sometimes it can be easier to relate to one kid over the other because you may have the same interests as one child. But as a parent, because you want to foster a strong relationship with all of your children, you can be very intentional about going out of your way to say, well, so-and-so really likes to read, so let's read books together when I spend time with that child. And when I'm spending time with the other child, I'll go and play some sports with them. And but you're entering their world and you're taking note of what they're interested in and you're finding a way to relate to them on their level.
Makes sense.
When you said favoritism, I honestly thought you meant something like, you know, the exact same behavior in both kids is being dealt with very differently. Mm. You know, so maybe one parent or one, the parent is maybe harder on one child than on another or something like that. That's kind of what I was imagining when you said the word favoritism.
Yeah, and I'm you can see that too, I'm sure, in a lot of households. So,
yeah, I mean, it's just about being consistent, but also about being fair. And I like to talk about, you know, the definition of being fair is literally meeting a child where they're at. So we're not going to put a first grader in 10th grade math. That would be totally unfair, right? Like, so we're going to put the first grader in first grade math. So if we have an 8-year-old child and we have a 2-year-old child, we're going to address them according to what is fair in terms of how much can they understand and what's appropriate for helping them learn and get to the next level.
Okay, that makes perfect sense as well. All right, so we got a few more questions before we finish up. Now, my 1-year-old has, or 1.5-year-old has started noticing some different private parts and body parts and whatnot and asking questions. When do we start really talking about private parts? And then on top of that as well, double-edged sword here, do we have nicknames for our private parts or do we not? Because I know there's a lot of parents out there that just use nicknames and kids get to school and there's, you know, weirdness and all kinds of things about what these parts really mean or what they really are or what the real word for them is, I guess.
A 1.5-year-old noticing private parts already, huh? I guess that's accurate.
Yeah.
That's pretty accurate.
And sometimes it's earlier and sometimes it's later.
Yeah.
I think the main thing is also just understanding that as they grow older, you want them to have an open conversation with you about things that can be really sensitive. And so being able to go into it, that the child, especially at 1.5, is going to sense your emotions around it. So being able to have that comfortability is going to be really important. So there is a lot of controversy on how to address this, though, and I think sometimes that has to do with also the family values in general.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that because if you think about it, a child at that young of an age really doesn't know anything except any better except for what you present as the parent. So if you're really intense about it or nervous or embarrassed and use little nicknames, right, they're going to take your lead. If you just name the body part like you would any other body part and you're more neutral towards it and make it easy to talk about, no matter what, they're going to take your lead. So in all of these situations, a child is going to take your lead. So it's really a good idea to step back and think about, you know, what do I want around this topic? Do I want them to be able to come to me and talk to me no matter what, no matter how old they are? Do I foster that currently, you know, or do I put my own, essentially my own biases around this and like get them to a point where they now have inherited that as well? So is this a hush-hush topic? Do we need to be embarrassed about it? If you present in that way, they will also.
Yeah, and it definitely is very touchy. And it could also go back to what we were taught as kids and what we went through and what we believe. But it can cause some other issues down the road as well if it's not addressed really in the very best way. So I just want to be clear there. There's a lot of great books. As a dad, single dad for a long time, you know, one thing that I really believed in is just being real. Like you said, you know, it's just another body part. This is my finger, you know, this is my thumb, this is my nose. Because then they do get kind of like embarrassed sometimes and then it is hush hush or like there's the giggling behind it as kids get a little bit older and then they see something and it just causes other behaviors potentially that we don't really want to see down the road with kids as well.
So there's that. And then there's something that we say on this podcast all the time, I think, is if you don't tell your child about it, they'll end up finding out some other way. And so you really want to talk about, or you really want to think about as parents, you know, who do you want educating your child on that issue?
Absolutely.
Most of the time, parents are going to say they know that it needs to be them. And so if you're having trouble with learning how to do it differently, because all you know is the way that you were raised, that's a time when you can reach out for help. You know, that we work with that kind of stuff all the time in our sessions. Yeah. That's a really common conversation we have with families, you know, and so we can absolutely help with something like that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of times where they're, you know, the spouses are kind of, you know, they're on different sides of the spectrum as far as how they want to address it as well. And so that may need some counseling just in that area. And that's a really cool thing about psychology and what we offer at the clinic is it's, you know, it's not always about somebody needing help because there's an issue, or whatnot, but just looking for additional education is always key. So anyway, yes, if you don't teach your child, they definitely will learn from someone else. Little Johnny's at school waiting to tell everybody about what he knows, right? That bad right. kid, that ODD kid, right? So watch out for little Johnny. Oh, all right. My kid is a picky eater. Mac and cheese and chicken nuggets is all we can do. What am I going to do? Because this does not work. I can't make mac and cheese and chicken nuggets every night. I'm tired of eating it myself. I don't want to make two meals. What do I do? Now, I know you guys love this question because of your eating disorder.
I just want to keep on asking more questions is the problem.
Yeah, there's like, not
what's
enough
the age, right? what's happening?
There's a lot of reasons why kids become picky eaters. And being a picky eater says a lot about someone's relationship with food, but the fact that they got to that point in their relationship is multi-layered. I mean, there's just so much behind it. And you're right, we would talk about this forever because of our eating disorder background. And so I highly recommend that if your child is a picky eater, you are concerned about picky eating, you have no idea what to do next, you've spoken to your pediatrician, asked your friends everything that you know you've wanted to talk about or concerned about, and you're still not finding answers, please call and get some help.
Well, and it's kind of funny you said that because all that I know about picky eating now, because I'm surrounded by brilliant people all the time in this area, I would just, as a dad, knowing what I know now, I would just say, look, if it's a question, if you're worried about it, first of all, don't ask your friends. Don't get on Facebook. They don't have the right answer. So don't actually do that at all. Okay. Don't ask your pediatrician because they don't know anything about eating habits either. It's okay. They're gonna eat when they're hungry and they're gonna get enough nutrients, right?
I can't tell you how many times we've heard that.
So if your kid is a picky eater, and
sometimes it's true.
Sometimes it
and
is.
And sometimes it's not
a
true.
A lot of times it's not true.
But the cool thing is if you've got experts out there that can give you real guidance and give you real support, and it may not be an issue, it may be okay just depending on the situation, but wouldn't you rather know the truth than not? You know, that's really where the rubber meets the road. So I would always say go to an expert, find out really what's going on, and then you have the answers, and it's really that simple. So how do you like that?
I love it.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So I got one more, actually I got two more questions, and this is going to be pretty easy. But not really. So, all right. Our kids, they try every button we have. They push every button. We only have so much in the day left at sometimes. Sometimes I just really do not like my kids. What's wrong with me? Is that normal? Do I need to get help myself for feeling that way? What's going on?
That's a great question. First of all, is it normal? Yes, it's normal. Okay, to a certain degree. I mean, if you find that it's like a chronic thing and it's really impacting the parent-child relationship and there's something bigger going on, then you absolutely need to step back from that. But happening every once in a while, you're exhausted, it's been a long day, you find your child whining extremely annoying, or you wonder, you know, when is this ever going to stop? I can't wait for my child to just enter the next stage and grow up a little bit, and you find yourself wishing their life away, essentially, a lot of that is normal. And so, you know, I always go back to, are you taking care of yourself? If you're finding that that's happening more often, Are you doing what you need to do to prevent burnout? If you are burnt out, are you even getting the basics? Are you getting enough sleep? Are you eating well? Are you getting enough hydration? Are you getting any sunlight, you know, or movement?
Are you using Calgon?
Right?
It's an ongoing joke. You probably don't know what Calgon is, gosh. Dr. Smith, but
I didn't know what it was either.
If you go Google Calgon, it's like from the 1970s. There's a really great, it was an ad on TV that I just remember because I guess my mom was like, Calgon, take me away. That was the whole saying. So anyway, well, and there's also a saying out there as well that's why God made babies so cute. Because no matter how much they try you and take every ounce of you, especially mommies, you look at them like, oh, you're just so cute. It's okay.
Yeah, I love you, right? So I always want to check on that. You know, how is the parent doing? Are they taking care of themselves? If you have those moments where you just really don't like certain aspects of your kid, that's okay. But also understand that it's not for you to take personally. A lot of what kids do that frustrate us or that we find annoying or unlikable are just really a normal part of their development. They're learning how to use their voice. They're learning how to exert control and make decisions. And like I said earlier, understand their impact on their environment. And so they may do it in ways that we find extremely unlikable. And at the same time, you know, we just need to be patient and understanding that this is just the life stage they're in. My favorite is like when they repeat themselves over and over and over and over again just to get what they want, or they assume something, right, that is going to happen a certain way, even though you're giving them exactly what they want, but they've just already decided that the outcome is going to be unfavorable, and so they're super upset about it, even though you're standing there like, hey, man, I said you could have this. Like, why well, it's are like you
a,
so
I was just I was thinking about our two-year-old earlier today. He's getting ready to be three, but getting ready to go to school this morning, and he does this cool jump trick. And so we give him praise. He's looking for praise. First of all, he's fighting us for attention, for the praise. And so he does it again, and we give him the praise, and he goes, and then he does it again, and we're like, yay, yay, go, go, go. You know, and it's like, come on, man.
Yeah.
You know, really?
What do you think about that one, Dr. Smith? Is it normal not to like your kid?
From time to time, absolutely. I think any healthy relationship, you're not going to like anyone the whole time.
Yep.
You know, like even your best friend, there may be things that you're like, that really just, I don't like that part of you, you know? And so just like thinking of it from that perspective, does that mean the relationship's unhealthy? No, but are you seeing other things that are causing an unhealthy relationship? That's when you should be reaching out, or just kind of like you said, burnout. Burnout's usually, that's especially when I'm like, I am not liking many people in general.
All right. So great points there. Last question, last topic really quick, bedtime. What's an appropriate bedtime for my kid? Let's start there really quick.
Don't you want to ask a bunch of more questions? It all depends on the child, right? It depends on how old they are. It depends on how early they have to wake up the next day.
Let's just say we got school, you know, school grade kids, you know, elementary, whatever. What's a good bedtime?
I always think it's a better question asking how much sleep are they getting at night? Are they getting an appropriate amount of sleep? And that's going to depend on the age, and that's going to depend on the kid. Some kids are more on the lesser side of sleeping, while other kids need a lot more sleep. And so a lot of it is more focused on that, as well as I think of just like the family dynamic in general. When does school start for this kid? Because elementary schools start, I don't even know what time anymore. It sounds like sometimes I get like 7:15 and sometimes I get 8:30, and I'm like, well, that makes it a little confusing. Yep. I think the main thing is, are they getting a sufficient amount of sleep? And is it mostly during the dark times?
There's that. And then I also like to ask the question, like, what works for your family too? Because if you don't really get to see your child and you get home a little bit later than some parents do, you might want them to be up a little bit longer so you can spend some time with them, and you adjust the morning if you have that freedom so that they still get enough sleep. There are other families that, you know, they just need their kids in bed a little earlier so that they can have their own time.
So they have their Calgon.
Right, exactly.
But yeah,
we're going to have to like link
the Calgon.
It's
really not a bedtime. It's really about an amount of sleep and healthy sleep.
Yeah, and like I've even heard of one family where it was the dad was a doctor, and so he had really kind of extended hours, and one of the kids would wake up when he woke up and then would go right back to sleep after he went to sleep. And they just like watched that and say, like, tried to see, okay, does it seem like this kid's tired throughout the day? Is it happening where it's causing any harm? And it was, no, that just was the way that that kid spent some time with their daddy.
Yeah.
That's awesome. All right. So kids, it's just all about the amount of sleep that they need. I've got a good friend who's not getting any sleep at night usually because his 4-year-old is still in bed with them. So because of her tossing and turning all night, he's not getting sleep. How do we get kids out of our beds?
That's a good question. How do you get kids out of your bed? This is, again, there's a lot more questions I want to ask. Like, how long has this been going on? What's normally the response when they do crawl into bed? When do they crawl into bed? And then what has a parent already tried? If they're truly working on getting kids to sleep in their own bed, the key is consistency and collaboration, right? So both parents have to be on the same page, and they have to respond exactly the same way every single time until the child starts learning how to sleep in their own bed. And so what that means is if you have to get out of bed over and over again in the middle of the night to walk your child back to their room, you do that until they start sleeping in their own bed.
And is the parent ready?
Yeah.
Is the parent like, ready? Is the parent that truly is a very ready?
Good question.
Yes.
You know, because with that consistency, like you said, are you at a point where you can do that?
Yes, I totally agree with that.
One, it's just like any habit. You got to break the habit. It's going to be tough in the beginning. It's going to take some time, some hard work, but it's definitely worth it in the end. All right, so final question is, you're both mommies. Tell me about your household.
That's a whole nother episode.
Well, we thank you for joining into the Parent Survival Podcast from Surviving to Thriving in Your Household. It was an honor having you, Dr. Smith, on the podcast today. We definitely want you back very soon for part two. Dr. Swalen, as always, I'll see you soon. I know you always like me, so don't even try to say you don't. Again, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you again next week.